Okay, we'll assume it's a plane anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they say the exact same spot both times. They're out
there, like I say that. Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Marlisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello, and welcome to edition 440 of Strange Days Indeed. Hey, we hit the quarter mile mark with this one. This week, the 3rd in May 2007, weekly editorial contributor Dave Berlot, Canadian documentarian Paul Kimball talks the best evidence, the top 10 UFO cases, and as he does every couple of weeks, Alfred Lemberg takes us home. These are strange days indeed. And since we're talking the best UFO cases, I thought I'd mention that MSN has published its top 25 web-based hoaxes, and among many interestings, the number 13 slot goes to the alien autopsy film. The listing reads, number 13, alien autopsy at Roswell, New Mexico, 1995. Roswell, New Mexico, ground zero of UFO controversy. It's also where the movie of the Roswell alien autopsy was filmed 60 years ago. The story goes that a UFO crashed at this site, and the U.S. government performed a hush-hush autopsy on the dead alien. In the mid-1990s, unnamed individuals discovered the secret film and posted it for the edification of a disinformed public. Looks pretty real, right? Now fast forward to 2006 and a conspiracy-deflating admission. The movie is a hoax created in 1995 by John Humphreys, the animator famous for Max Headroom, in his apartment in North London. Or was it? Nah, it was created by American Computer Corporation, Billy Meier, Reg Presley, Cal Korf, Alfred Weber, Stephen Greer, Billie Jean King, and Sergio Mendez and Brazil 66. See what you learn when you listen to Strange Days Indeed?
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berlot.
There's a thread on the UFO updates list that, quite frankly, I've done my very best to remain quiet on. The thread begins as just a few Roswell questions and has been going on since April 21. Removing my socks to help with the counting. In other words, it's been going on almost, for some 30 days now. Currently, the discussion is now centering around whether daylight savings time should be considered an issue about when somebody supposedly missed lunch. Oh, and it gets better. We have to concern ourselves with whether the sun was setting or not, and the angle of the shadows telling us what time it was. But as is correctly pointed out, that's only truly valid when you can determine where north is located. Now, all of this comes back to the very famous press photograph showing the non-flying saucer debris in General Ramey's office. And what truly throws me about all of this is that people are arguing over and over about whether the debris being held up by Major Jesse Marcel is something other than a weather balloon and some busted-up Rowan reflectors. Now, some people argue that the debris is cleverly disguised to appear like a crashed weather balloon. Some people are arguing about whether some real debris is mixed in with the fake debris that was shown to the press to throw them off the track. And then, of course, we have others that say it's the real thing and that the crash was a weather balloon, and they know this because, well, that's what the Air Force tells us it was. So people have questions, and when those questions are not answered the way they would like them to be answered, they simply ask the same question with different wording. Now, I have questions about Roswell, and I keep asking them, but nobody has provided me with an answer that makes sense. I'm not saying I don't like the way they've answered my question. They simply haven't given me one. Question one. How is it possible for an officer with the rank of major in military intelligence not to be capable of telling the difference between a crashed weather balloon or Mogul balloon and a flying saucer? Two, did Colonel Blanchard issue an order to release a press release stating that they captured a flying saucer as a joke? Or was he hoping the story would keep the media away from investigating the much larger story about the crash of a top-secret Mogul balloon? Now, somebody out there has the answer to those questions. I don't know who it is, and I don't know who they are, but I do know that somebody knows. I also don't know what the answers to the questions are, but I really would love to hear somebody give it a try. For all I know, it could have been Blanchard, Marcel, Brazel, the town sheriff, and even Walter Hout, sitting around enjoying the fireworks of the storm, swilling down bottle after bottle of whiskey, and they hatched up this great plan to collect the reward for getting evidence of some crashed flying saucer. Now, if memory serves me, the reward for that material was a whopping $1,000. You divide that by five, and you get a whole $200 in your pocket. That's a fortune back in those days. Well, at least it's enough to keep the boys in booze for a few days. You see, the problem I have with Roswell is not just a few Roswell questions. Nope, not in the least. Just a few Roswell questions don't concern me. What concerns me are the answers. We don't need to ask more Roswell questions. We got tons of them. What we need are more Roswell answers. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Days, indeed.
And your take this week, Dave Furlong, took it right out of my mind as I posted that thing about the time of day and whether it was central or was it summertime or was it Mars time or, and I thought, oh my God, the minutia in this is just getting ridiculous.
Oh, it is. It is. It's like, I don't care what time it was, guys. And to be quite honest, I defy almost anyone to look at a picture and be able to tell me exactly what time it is without having a date and time stamp on it. Come on. Let's focus on some of the stuff that's out there that's a little more definitive. There is not a prayer that the stuff that was in Ramey's office was from the real debris field. It was brought in. They even admitted they brought it in to show that it was a weather balloon. That's it.
I don't know whether we've done Roswell to death quite yet or not.
I don't think we can ever do Roswell to death, basically because we don't have any of the answers. That's the point that I'm making, is we keep asking the questions and the same questions over and over again, but we're not getting any answers anywhere. When we think we might have some kind of an answer, it gets shot down completely.
That's the way it's going to continue, I have the feeling. We will never get an answer. Or will we?
Well, I hope we do.
Oh, I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I admire the patience of people like Kevin Randall and Stanton T. Friedman, who just climb in and point things out and fade into the background again until the next strange observation comes up.
They do it quite nicely. I have to give them the credit that they don't come in and go, squat, go away, you stupid idiot. We've answered this question 27 times before.
Yes, and it's all in the archive.
It is indeed, and that's what they should take a look at as well, is people should start going into that archive and reading it and reading it and reading it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all there.
I'm sure the Roswell posts number in the thousands there now out of the 70-something thousand that are there.
Thousands easily. Maybe even tens of thousands about Roswell.
Oh, God. Oh, no. Confuse the world. Cloud the issue with facts.
Oh, yes. What do we need facts for? Those are, what was it, what Stanton's saying?
Don't bother me with the facts.
Yeah,
my mind is made
That's
up.
That's it. That's it. And the noisy negativists.
Noisy negativists and fossilized physicists.
I love that one.
Yes, if you don't know what you're talking about, shut up. Dave Furlot, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week.
For sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Joining us on the line from his office, Red Star Films in Halifax, Nova Scotia, is documentary filmmaker Paul Kimball. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Errol, from all of us at the Red Star Empire.
It's been a month or two since we last talked on the program, if not much longer.
Yeah, no, I think it's, I was looking through your archives, I think it's last September, because I was on to talk about Fields of Fear.
Right.
And I was going to be on in December, I think, to talk about Best Evidence, and I got bumped, no offense, by Peter Davenport, because you had the O'Hare thing was breaking.
Yes,
so I think that
and
was
I felt badly about that, and I wanted to reschedule you for the radio program, and suddenly the radio program was gone.
I have that effect on people and things, so I'm sure I'm the proximate cause of that. I'm sure they said, Paul Kimball, oh no, you know, no more radio show. But you live on in the podcast universe, and frankly, I've listened to some of the shows you've done. The nice thing is they're cleaner and meaner and leaner, and it sounds like you sort of don't have, maybe not that you did have restrictions, but you can have more fun, just really get into stuff that you want to get into. So I actually think it's, no offense to the old show, which was great, I think the new show is an improvement.
I feel that way too. We're uninterrupted by news and commercials, and I don't really have to worry about a boss, because this is the boss sitting right here talking with his own mouth at the moment.
Same here. Although, I suppose I have to worry about broadcast bosses. You know, we all have bosses at some point or another.
Mm.
But yeah, no, I know what you mean. There's something liberating to being master of your own ship and captain of your own soul or whatever it is. So, yeah, I'm guessing you'd still rather be on the radio.
It's quick and dirty and over in 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, there's a lot of tidying and packaging and producing to do, so...
You become a documentary producer, sort of. For radio.
Yeah. What amazes me is that I'm cranking out, well, basically a 90-minute radio program with all kinds of interesting stuff and some not bad production values,
mm-hmm.
technology aside. And it's a one-man operation. I'm amazed. I'm personally staggered by it.
Well, as well you should be, because it's a fine program.
In the UFO field, you're known as a UFO documentary maker, and unless people have actually been to your Red Star Films website, they would not have seen the fact that you are making other kinds of documentaries as well.
If you look at the amount of programming I've done over the years, I've done more music-related programming for Bravo, including 2 seasons of classical music performance series a couple of years ago, and the next documentary that I'm going to be working on is also classical music related. I've produced or directed films on the blues and jazz and other stuff, and small town professional wrestling. So yeah, you know, I get introduced at parties down here, film industry parties, as the UFO guy. So it's not just UFO people who do it, it's people within the industry sometimes who do it. In fact, I got introduced to Jeff Regan, former federal cabinet minister, at a film industry Christmas party as the UFO filmmaker, Paul Kimball.
I guess it has a certain amount of cachet nowadays to be a UFO filmmaker.
I don't know about that. You'd have to ask my banker whether there's any cachet that goes to that. I don't think they're convinced yet. It's a subject I have an interest in beyond filmmaking and always did. So the fact that I can make the odd film about a subject that I like and actually enjoy is music is another one. I used to be a musician in a different life. So music and UFOs, it's nice to be able to make films about subjects that I enjoy as opposed to doing something like, you know, season 9 of Survivor or something like that. No matter how much it would pay, it's not something that I would be particularly interested in doing. Unless Mark Burnett calls me, in which case, hey, I'm there.
Maybe we can point him to this podcast and say, hey, Mark, go listen to this.
There you go.
Yes. So where did the scathingly brilliant idea come from to produce a documentary about the best UFO evidence?
The interesting thing is, in a very traditional way, it's not a documentary. It's the top 10. And this one or two UFO longtime researchers didn't want to participate because they didn't think that it had merit. It was designed originally to be a top 10 film, the kind of thing you see on Much Music or something where, hey, number 10, number 9, it's like a countdown. In a normal documentary, what you would probably do is either take one case and delve into that, or you'd take the phenomenon as a whole, as I assume David Cherniak is doing, for instance, and take a look at that as a rolling kind of story. But the top 10 films, it's very quick. You've got 4, maybe 5 or 6 minutes per segment, and it's hard to tell a story in 4 or 5 or 6 minutes and do it justice, especially, say, a complex story like the Tehran case or the RB-47 case. So in a truly traditional sense, I don't actually consider it a documentary on the one hand. On the other hand, the first thing my brother, who works with me, said to me when he walked in the next day, and I asked him, what did you think of the film? Because the first time he saw We Delivered So Late was on television that night. And he said, well, I thought you were going to make a flashy top 10 kind of film, and you made a documentary. So, you know, I didn't set out to make a documentary, but I guess in a roundabout way, once I got involved in the making of it, the idea was to try and tell stories and to try and have an overarching story as well. You listen to a musical top 10, hey, here's the Beatles, here's the Rolling Stones, and then here's the Grassroots. They're all separate bands with separate songs. And I just dated myself there by picking those three bands. But what I tried to do was provide an underlying theme to the film so that even if you were seeing like top 10 cases, and they're all sort of different in many respects, that there was a thread or two running throughout it. And as Dave Furlot mentioned on last show, one of the threads that you might be able to pick out is that the government, in this case in particular the United States Air Force, has some pretty goofy explanations for what some pretty good people claim to have seen. So how did I come up with the idea? Well, the idea basically, Errol, was it's hard to sell UFO documentaries. It's not impossible, but the market is oversaturated. There's a lot of stuff out there. Most of it, frankly, isn't very good. So it's always a mix, and you see this on your list sometimes with people complaining about documentaries about the UFO phenomenon, and they say, well, it's too much oriented towards the entertainment sector, and it's not serious enough, and it didn't take us seriously, and blah, blah, blah. And these are all written by people who have absolutely no idea about what it's like to try and produce any documentary. It's entertainment, folks. It's the television industry. At the end of the day, if you're not entertaining people, you don't have a job. Nobody in my industry would have a job if you can't entertain. The trick is, and what I've always tried to do, is entertain and inform. And space, here in Canada, kudos to them, has been very good over the years at letting me do a bit of both. So I thought, well, let's try and ramp up the entertainment quotient by doing a top 10 film, because space, which is also owned by Chum, which owns the music channels, they love that stuff. You know, top 10 monsters, top 10 crypto-terrestrial creatures or something. So here's the top 10 UFO cases of all time, and let's take a look at them and count them down. And that's basically how it came about, trying to meld the entertainment aspect with the informational aspect in a way that hopefully wouldn't offend anybody and might actually please not only the small group of UFO buffs, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but you know what I mean, the people who sort of are really into UFOs.
Yeah, seriously interested is all I
have to call them. Exactly, that's what I mean. So it would please them, but it would also be accessible to the wide majority of people who might know what the term UFO is, but don't really care very much about it. It's not part of their day-to-day lives. And frankly, no offense to those folks that are really into UFOs, but I make films for that other group, the much larger group that maybe doesn't know as much. And you have to, because otherwise you're making a film for 1,000 people maybe, and networks tend not to want to license that kind of stuff. So there you go.
Once you got the skeleton together, how did you flesh it out? I mean, how did you come to the conclusion that the top 10 cases that you used in your film were a general consensus of what the top 10 cases are?
Well, there's a spinning wheel in my office with a number of darts, and so I just put all the case names on and I threw darts up. I polled or surveyed a group somewhere between, I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, 25 to 30 UFO researchers around the world, many of whom were willing to be known, and so they're listed at the back end of the film. A few others preferred to remain, as they say, sub rosa. They were happy to give me a list, but didn't want their names used for whatever reason. A few of them are people that have more or less retired from the UFO field, so to speak. So I took those lists, and I said, everybody give me a top 10 list, or as Dick Hall called it, a 10 of the best, because Dick was quite right. He said, look, I can't give you the top 10. I'll just give you the 10 that I think are the best.
Mm-hmm.
And then I assigned points to each case. So if you voted Rendlesham at number 10, it got 1 point. If you voted Tehran at number 9, it got 2, and so on down to the number 1 case, which would get 10. Then I averaged them all together. And I said, well, the cases that got the most points are the ones with a couple of exceptions that are going to be in the film. There are some cases that I just thought would be unfilmable for any one of a number of reasons. It would be tremendously difficult to film or tell the story. From the get-go, I said, if one of those cases winds up in there, then I will use my editorial discretion to take it out. Fortunately, that didn't happen. But one thing that did happen is I bumped the case that was at number 10 off the list. So it's really a top 9 with, and then an asterisk. And I stuck the Nuremberg 1561 sighting in because a couple of people had made the point to me, and I had already started to think that I wanted to make the point, that the UFO phenomenon predates 1947, which is the year that the vast majority of people, because of Kenneth Arnold and Roswell and other things, sort of look at and say, oh, well, UFOs, whatever they are, suddenly started appearing in 1947. So I wanted to start the film off by saying, no, they didn't. And here's a representative kind of case from the pre-1947 era, in fact, 400 years before that, almost. Mm. So, you know, I use my editorial discretion to do that, and if that sort of miffs people, all I can say is the 10th case wasn't all that good anyway. I mean, who really wanted to hear about Socorro again? So, you know, I'm just kidding. Whatever case I bumped off, I can't even remember what it was now.
I was going to ask you about that, but then you answered my question, and
was the number 10 case? Either Socorro or the Washington Flap of 1952. I'm
right.
Pretty sure it was one of those two cases. Mm-hmm. Might have been Trindade. All three of those cases were sort of in the top 15 somewhere. And the truth is, Errol, the number one case, the RB-47 case, was so far head and shoulders above all the other cases in terms of points that it was easy. From 2 to 5 were in a different group, less than RB-47, but still more than the cases that followed them. Everything from 6 to about 20 was separated maybe by 4 points or 5 points or 6 points. I mean, they were all close. So at number 8, you've got the Yukon case in 1996. If somebody had shifted Yukon from number 5 to number 8 and pushed Washington from 8 to 5, then you would have had the Washington case in there maybe. So in a sense, it illustrates just the number of good cases that are out there. But to me, it also illustrated that when you start to winnow them down, there are about 3 or 4 cases, maybe five cases, that the vast majority of UFO researchers, knowledgeable ones, really focus in on and say, these are the ones that we should be taking forward. And those are pretty much the 5 cases that wind up at the top 5 in my film.
Have you had feedback from the researchers that were involved?
Dan Friedman saw it. He quite liked it. Dan carried the ball on a couple of cases, one in particular, the Yukon case. I really wanted to get out and interview Martin Jasek in British Columbia, and if I'd been there, I would have bumped up to the Yukon and had an offer to interview one or two of the witnesses from the case. And because of budget and timing constraints, just couldn't do it. Martin was helpful in the early stages, and I certainly would have liked to have interviewed him. Unfortunately, I couldn't get out there. You just have to pick and choose and make choices, and that was one of the choices I had to make.
Yeah.
But Stan, who has long been a champion of the 1996 Yukon sighting, basically stepped in and helped tell the story. So, you know, Martin would have been better, and I mean no offense to Stan, but Stan would be the first to tell you Martin's the guy who did the investigation. But, you know, Stan was an able fill-in. The other people who were in the film, to the best of my knowledge, haven't seen it. Brad Sparks, who was our historical consultant, and Brad, for the last year and a half, and I have worked very closely on this project, and I owe a big debt of gratitude to Brad for everything he brought. Brad saw individual case clips. So if with McMinnville, I would email him the case and say, here's what we've come up with. You know, what do you think? And he saw all the scripts beforehand for each case. But other than that, no, he's the only UFO researcher, other than Stan, I think, who's seen the film. Don Ledger apparently saw the last half of it.
Yes.
So he missed the Shag Harbor case, which is in the first half. There hasn't been any feedback. I will be getting DVDs made and sending them out to the people who helped us come up with the list and some people who will review it as well, like Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop will hopefully review it for their website. The reaction will dribble in. But thanks to Dave Furlott for last week saying, what did he say? It was a magnificent film. Perfect. I mean, as a filmmaker, I mean, you just can't ask for anything better.
No, you can't.
Thanks to Dave for that.
And to go back to the Yukon case, I don't know whether you knew or not, or whether you caught it, but Martin had worked with a crew of documentary makers who made a film for the Aboriginal People's Television Network here in Canada on that case.
Yes, I was aware of that, the APTN. In fact, I saw a bit of it, I think, on the Internet, on YouTube or someplace. I caught a bit of it. One of the other things, too, that I was careful about was not replicating cases that had already been covered in depth. The Yukon case had already made it on the list, and that wasn't a problem. One case that, if it had made on the list, I probably would have removed would have been the Minot Air Force Base case, because I thought the Peter Jennings special 2 years ago covered that case in a short period of time, which is what I would have had, far better than I could have done. So at some point you say, well, let's assume Minot Air Force Base gets in and Malmstrom doesn't. Why, I'm just going to take Minot out and put Malmstrom in, because Malmstrom is a good case too. And I didn't have to do that because Malmstrom actually polled higher than Minot, but Minot was in the top 20. I think it was like 16 or 17. And early on it was in the top 10 and then sort of fell out. I probably would not have used the Minot Air Force Base case simply because Jennings, the seeing is believing thing, had already done it as well, as far as I'm concerned, as it could be done at this time. So what's the point of repeating myself?
An honest piece of reportage without too much monkeying around in the editing room. That segment, anyway.
Yeah, well, as I said 2 years ago, I thought the first half of the Jennings special was great, and I didn't mind the second half quite as much as everybody else did, but I sort of ignore it. So if I go back and watch it, I watch the first half, and then I'll watch Michio Kaku, and I kind of ignore the stuff on Roswell. And the abduction phenomenon or enigma, probably because those two things don't really interest me very much anyway. So I kind of skip over them. So.
Aside from the Yukon case, were there any cases that you dropped simply because of production considerations?
No. The nine cases that are in from 1 till 9 are the cases that were 1 to 9. I did switch two cases, number-wise. Didn't really make a difference. They were very close anyway. I will never say what they were, but let's just say I wanted to not run two cases from the same country back to back. So I moved one space forward and moved another case one space back.
Mm-hmm.
But that was it. Other than that, no, it was what it was.
It was a good was, too.
No, thanks.
I thought you did an excellent job and a very fair presentation. It was a damn fine piece of work, given budgets and time and the various constraints that filmmakers come across during the course of putting a production together. I thought it was damn fine.
Oh, thanks very much. Timing is always an issue, too, trying to squeeze 10 cases in. I heard Stuart Miller, our good friend, on your show last week, not complaining about being left on the cutting room floor, but actually saying he wasn't surprised. I would have loved to have kept Stuart in the Rendlesham segment. Despite what Stuart says, his clip was very good. At the end of the day, though, he was quite right. You're going through and saying, well, what goes and what stays? And the Rendlesham segment was already long enough, and I had Nick Pope basically saying some of the same things that Stuart was saying. It was Nick that I went over there really to interview. It was, frankly, a better shot. It's outside Parliament and all that stuff. It's really cool. So I kept Nick, and Stuart, yeah, got left on the cutting room floor, but he wasn't the only one. Thanks to Stuart for sitting down for the interview. and putting Nick Redfern and I up in his house for a few days last year, from whence we did one of your shows, actually.
Yes, I recall that.
I was listening to it last night going, oh, my God, we must have been drunk because we were sort of wild men.
I think you were just punchy because of the five-hour time difference.
Yeah, well, that would have something to do with it. And I think Stuart spikes his tea with some sort of illegal substance. I'm not sure. So everybody in his house seems very happy. That's all I can say. So the point that Stuart was going to make in the film about the Rendlesham case that we didn't make because I took it out was that Rendlesham's just a weird place. Having been to Rendlesham, it is. It's a weird, even after the hurricane, the forest is a spooky, creepy, weird place, even during a brightly sunlit day. It's very odd. And if you read Redfern's book, Three Men Seeking Monsters, you'll see stories about devil dogs taking place in Rendlesham. As Stuart made the point, it has a long history of things that predate the 1980 sort of UFO incident. And I thought that would be a very interesting thing to say to provide context, and unfortunately context sort of got booted out simply because I had to tell the story, and the Rendlesham case, because it was spread out over 2 days and it was ranked number 3 on our list, was a very complex story to try and tell. So, no context, no Stuart, but he'll be in the DVD on the extras because it was a good clip.
We are talking to a lot of people who are doubtlessly a little frustrated because they haven't had the chance to see this documentary yet. You mentioned DVD. When is that likely to hit the web so that people around the planet can buy it?
Well, here's the business aspect of it. We have a British distributor who's looking, you know, it's already sold to Television New Zealand, and we'll be looking to sell it into other countries, so you might be able to see it on free TV sooner rather than later somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the DVD, that's up to them in terms of finding a distributor and a sub-distributor that can do all that sort of stuff. And because of the deal that I have struck with them, I can't start sort of selling DVDs willy-nilly on my own. So unfortunately, it'll take time for them to get whatever deal they're going to structured or figure out how they're going to go about doing that.
Mm.
It also takes me time to sift through all the footage, and there's a fair amount, to try and decide what I would put on as bonus materials and what I would not put on as bonus materials. Because the idea I would like to do is do a two-disc DVD set. I mean, I have a lot of interview footage with Dick Hall, for instance, that I didn't use. I have a lot of interview footage with Bruce McAbee. He talks at great length about the New Zealand case, which wasn't in the film, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of stuff that you could put in there that I think people interested in the UFO phenomenon would find very interesting.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I would guess, that's a very long-winded way of saying, the answer is probably mid to late summer by the time there's actually a DVD release ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, folks, if you don't live in Canada or New Zealand, it'll be airing in New Zealand sometime in, I think, the early summer. It's going to be a while. Other than review copies, I'll be sending review copies out to some people within ufology and the media and stuff. But for the general public, yeah, it's going to be a few months. But hopefully the wait will be worth it because of the extras, which I do intend to take my time and kind of try and do right.
And the extras are always, no matter what kind of DVD you get, are always a really nice add-on. Well, they're extras, and are usually fascinating.
There's some nifty stuff I could throw in, including some of the animation that we decided not to use. For instance, one of my favorite little bits, there's a map in the Tehran case. Dr. McAbee's talking about how they initially thought it might be a Soviet attack coming from the north, and quickly rule that out. So we have a map of the Soviet Union and Iran and an arrow, you know, like here they come. Unfortunately, the animators used the Islamic Republic flag to denote Iran. It was lovely animation, but I had to tell them, this is pre-revolutionary Iran. This is the Shah's era, fella. I don't want to go out of my way to tick off the president of Iran right now when he might be acquiring nuclear weapons. And he goes, hey, I saw this documentary, and they got the wrong flag. Get them, boys.
Where is this Red Star Films place? Oh, yeah. Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Mm. They sound like heathen godless communists or whatever. So that's one of the things that had to go back. And you go through that process. Brad Sparks is the only other one outside of myself and the animators who's ever seen it. In the Kelly Johnson case, the original, it's sort of a flying wing-shaped object that they show in the animation. Originally, as Brad described it, it was a bowler hat with a mustache. And it looked, well, patently ridiculous is the only way to describe it. And in sort of a Spinal Tap moment, I was at a bar with the animators, and the guy sketched it out for me in a cocktail napkin. and said, hey, does this look okay to you? And, you know, it's on my fifth or sixth Keiths at the time, and I went, yeah, it looks great, man, whatever. And so it shows up in the animation. I go, oh, my God, did I approve this?
No.
It's like that scene in Spinal Tap where they lower Stonehenge and it's 8 inches tall or whatever. The fun thing to me as a filmmaker is always to tell some of the weird little stories that went on, too, if for no other reason than the 20 people or whatever that worked on the film will find it amusing. Like why there's no footage of Rendlesham in the film. There isn't. There's no footage of Rendlesham Forest or anywhere around Rendlesham in the film, even though I went there, spent a whole day there, because I lost the tape. It's the only time in my career I've ever lost a tape. I got back to Halifax, was going through the tapes a few weeks later, and I went, where the heck is, you know, 19A or whatever it was? And it's just gone. To this day, I have no idea where it is.
Oh, my.
So I went all the way to Rendlesham. We had a lovely day, and, you know, Woodbridge is a wonderful town, and we had Cornish pasties and everything, and no tape. So
not in anybody's car, huh?
No. I'm sure I left it in the hotel or on the train. I don't know. It's, like I said, in 10 years in the industry, it's dealing with literally hundreds and hundreds of master tapes on the road. It's the only time I've ever misplaced a tape. So there you go. Rendlesham is just a weird place, and maybe the cosmic vortex that is Rendlesham sucked up the tape. I don't know. We were chased by black helicopters in Rendlesham, too.
You were?
Yeah. It's my Linda Moulton Howe moment, because I'm sure if it had been her, she would have written a book by now about how black helicopters chased her in Rendlesham. But because the base is closed, but they still use it, apparently, they were doing what pilots would call, I guess, touch and goes. So they'd fly in low over the forest, come in, touch down, fly up again, touch down, fly up again, and then take off. So the first time, though, because Rendlesham, the forest, kind of echoes, it increases every sound that you hear. It's like this giant dragon-like beating sound coming over the trees. My cameraman, Finley, and I were pretty concerned. And it
spooked.
Came, I don't know, 10, 15 feet above the treetops, this giant black helicopter with no markings. And so we had it on film on the tape that is now missing, you know.
Ugh.
But I did get pictures of it, too. And we were joking as we're walking along, going, hey, did you see those guys in the train station in Woodbridge? When they found out we were going to Rendlesham for the UFO thingy, they must have called the RAF or MI5, and now we're being stalked by black helicopters.
Yes.
So of all the trips I've ever made in my filmmaking career, the Rendlesham trip was definitely the weirdest. Black helicopters, lost tapes. It was just, it was a very odd, weird kind of trip, but a lot of fun.
Bizarre. And as has been said once or twice on this program, strange days.
Indeed.
When you travel, when you're making a documentary like Best Evidence, what sort of crew do you need?
Well, in this case, it was just Finley Muir and I, because of budget constraints again, and mostly because we were just doing interviews. So I didn't need a field sound guy, for instance, with the boom mic and everything, because it was all interior interviews with one or two exceptions. So it was just Finley and I. We traveled everywhere together, down through the States and over to the United Kingdom. When we were in the U.S., we had Mac Tonies along as camera assistant in California.
Mm.
I flew Mac out just so he and I could hang out. I'd never met Mac before. I met him in Kansas City. I said, hey, let's spend a couple days together out in California. So we did. And he actually helped Finley, as he did, though I have pictures of him as sort of a camera assistant. So he has an uncredited role in the film. Once we get back, though, then the people that deserve the thanks, and you'll see them at the end of the credits in the film.
There were a substantial number of names in there.
Yeah.
Most of whom, of course, I didn't recognize, but they were your production people. And looking at the credit roll at the end of the airing on Space Channel, I had to wonder what sort of crew you were traveling with, hence the question.
Yeah, only one, but to get that one out there, you need a production manager, and my brother Jim, the producer, Christine Boss, who was our production manager, a great young, I think, up-and-coming filmmaker in her own right. And then you get the animators, so all the names of all those guys, none of whom I've ever met. Brian Howells and Brendan McGraw are the two principals at Wingit Digital who did the animation for us. Brian's actually off working on the new Harry Potter film right now. But they brought in a lot of young animators to sort of do various segments of the film, so they're all listed there. John Rosborough and Alexander Rosborough, who did a bang-up job on sound, and John Rosborough with the music. He and I began in the music career together 15 years ago, playing in bands, different bands, but always on the same bill. We're both in the film industry now. Thor Henriksen, I can't say enough about Thor Henriksen. He's the guy who saved the film, literally. He came in to complete the online at the last minute, so big kudos to Thor. Charlotte Engel at Space, who gave us the time we needed to finish the film. And I guess last, but certainly not least, Chris Lee McBride, the young actress that I brought in to narrate the film, and I directed her in a play earlier. She was just a pleasure to work with. She's actually in the Daily News down here today, one of Halifax's two papers. She's profiled in the Almost Famous section, and she didn't mention Best Evidence. So I don't know. She hasn't seen it yet, actually. She was rehearsing for a play the night that it premiered, so I have to get her a DVD. Yeah, maybe she thinks that UFOs are not the kind of thing that you want to claim. She's an actress, so at the end of the day, narrating a film or being in a play, which would you choose? If you're an actress, you'd choose being in a play, I guess. If you have listeners in Nova Scotia, the Oxford Theatre on May 30th, the Nova Scotia Film Development Corporation is putting on a screening night. They do it once every 2 or 3 months. And my film, along with Mike McDonald's new film on Forrest Ackerman, Famous Monster, which was on Space last night, those are the two films that are going to be shown at the Oxford, 7 o'clock, May 30th, here in Halifax. So if you're in town, come on down.
And, of course, Mike McDonald is another Nova Scotian who has done UFO documentaries.
Yeah, he did the Shag Harbor incident and another one called Northern Lights, I think, which
mm-hmm.
was sort of a two-parter,
yes.
as I recall, in the Canadian UFO history or whatever.
And Don Ledger and Chris Stiles and I and several other Canadians were in that one, too.
Yeah, in fact, it's a very small town out here. The company that did the animation for us on Best Evidence is also the same company that did the animation for Mike on the Shag Harbor incident. So we joked. I said, can I save money if I just get you to, for the Shag Harbor segment in my film, reuse the stuff that you did for McDonald's in the Shag Harbor incident? And after those five keys, you know, that seemed like a very good idea, but then I decided to have them animate it, new kind of thing. I think the animation spruces the film up a lot and brings a number of the cases alive in maybe ways that haven't been done before.
Yeah.
It's just nice to get some of these cases out there. The original purpose of the film, which almost everybody in the UFO world understood with one or two exceptions, was never to be like a book or to write the definitive story of the RB-47 case or whatever. No film can do that. Not even a feature-length documentary, I don't believe, can do that. What it was meant to do, however, was to say to people, look, here's 10 good cases. Even if you can disprove or explain away 8 or 9 of them, you're still left with one. And as long as you have one case with credible witnesses, say in RB-47, the radar tracking and all that sort of stuff, if you have one of those cases, then this, as Mac Tony says at the end of the film, is something that you should take seriously. Does it mean it's aliens from outer space or extra dimensionals? No. Who knows what's going on? It could all be explained in mundane terms. I don't know.
Mm.
But it's worth having a look and not just sort of ignoring it. And the problem is, guys like Seth Shostak, and I hear him on his own radio show, always want to talk about Roswell, which I tend to agree with them is at best an extremely troublesome and controversial case, and at worst, well, and the Billy Meyer story. They always want to talk about Billy Meyer. And I said, you know what, instead of harping on Roswell again, and instead of harping on Billy Meyer or some of the crazier people out there, why don't you talk about the RB-47 case, Seth, or whoever? Why don't you have Brad Sparks on your show and debate him
mm-hmm.
about the RB-47 case? Or why don't you bring Bruce McAbee on and talk to him about the Tehran case? Or, and then on and on and on. Even better, why don't you bring someone like Lieutenant Colonel Bailey on to talk about RB-47 cases, including his own? Why don't you have Colonel Halt on to talk about Rendlesham or Bob Salas on to talk about Malmstrom? Why don't you ever do any of that stuff? And it's intellectually dishonest of those people to just harp on these few cases that they think they can make fun of without addressing the broader evidence, which I've tried to at least touch the surface of. And, you know, I wanted to call them on that. I'm no dyed-in-the-wool UFO ET believer kind of guy. As most people in the field would know, I'm actually quite skeptical to the point where many people think I'm a debunker myself. Not true. What I want is a serious look at the phenomenon. I hope the film makes the case that it's time for science and the media and journalists and historians to do that, even if it might not be the most pressing issue of the day, to at least take it more seriously and maybe not laugh at it quite so quickly, and realize that there are good cases out there with good people that deserve to be looked at in a serious way. So if it does that in any way, shape, or form, then I will have succeeded, and I can happily move on to do films about pro wrestling or something.
The problem with Seth Shostak of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is that he's really not qualified to discuss anything ufological because he apparently has not done a lot of research. And it would be like you or me or Stan Friedman voicing supposedly scientifically based opinions on SETI.
A lot of people, and I've been one of them over the last couple of years, beating the drum that science, you know, we need to get science, I'm not part of the we. As Stuart Miller noted, I'm always very careful not to use the word ufologist in the same sentence as my name.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a guy who has an interest. But if you are into ufology, there are people, and I've been one of them on the outskirts, saying, look, science needs to take this seriously. We've got to get science interested. And one of the things I realized when I was making this film is that the question you should ask yourself is why? Why do you want to get science interested? And in a lot of cases, I think it's because they crave the seeming respectability that having science take you seriously would bring, not only to the phenomenon, but also to you, the person who's interested in the phenomenon. And it's sort of a weird psychological thing there. I would say science has a role to play, absolutely, in the study of the UFO phenomenon, in the same way that I would say science has a role to play in the study of criminal cases, murders, those kinds of things. In DNA, in reconstruction, there are things that science can do very well. There are other things that science is lousy at. Interviewing witnesses, not really science. Anybody, you know, go get an astrophysicist or a biologist and put them in front of a person and say, look, interview this witness and try and get the details out of them without tainting the witness pool. Well, they're not trained to do that. So why would you want scientists to be doing it? Instead, you want investigators, you want oral historians, maybe people who have training with the police or something like that. Those are the people that you want performing that task. So one of the things I've taken out of the film, Errol, is you will probably hear me less and less beating the drum for serious science to take the UFO phenomenon seriously as if it were some sort of holy grail. In fact, what it is a piece of the puzzle and a piece of the investigative mechanisms that you need to pursue the phenomenon seriously, but it isn't the be-all and end-all, and you need other people from other fields to become involved as well. It needs to be a very broad-based effort, and I think that might be one of the mistakes I made. I got so hooked up in yelling that science needed to take it seriously, as if science is some monolithic entity anyway,
mm-hmm.
that you kind of lose sight of the forest for the trees. And I think that's something maybe some folks in ufology have done over the years as well. Maybe we can move away from that a bit, this need to have science put its imprimatur or whatever of respectability on you. If they want to get involved, great. As Maccabee in one of his outtakes said, look, they'd have to get up to speed, first of all, though, as you say, on the information, on the data, on the evidence. So really, it's in their ballpark to do that, and then they can come to the table and have a reasonable discussion with those who are already there.
And would we be any further ahead were they to do that?
Sure.
What would we learn?
I think you definitely would be, for instance, and engineers, too, as Stan Friedman has pointed out, you know, let's get engineers involved. If you are dealing with some sort of craft, and I don't know if you are or not, that's as much an engineering problem as it is some sort of scientific problem in the purest sense. But, yeah, no, of course there's things. Astrobiologists, physicists, astronomers, they all have something to add to the puzzle. But no one astronomer, no one physicist is going to be the overarching expert that could solve the riddle or could provide the one answer to the phenomenon, largely because there might not be just one answer to the phenomenon, something else I figured out. I mean, if you look at these 9-10 cases, you see, well, okay, there's similarities between those three, but that one over there is totally different. So maybe, and I'm just blue-skying here, but maybe that one over there represents alien visitation. Maybe that one over there is a natural phenomenon, and maybe that one over there is extra dimensionals. Who knows? So it's very possible that there is more than one explanation for the, quote, UFO phenomenon. And the truth is going to lie in investigating those cases that have good evidence. That's something Brad Sparks has been saying for years, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Project Blue Book files, which the vast majority of the Blue Book files have never really been looked at by anyone, except the original Blue Book people. There's a quote that we didn't use from Brad that will be in the DVD extras, but it's kind of the Indiana Jones thing. If you remember the end of the first Raiders of the Lost Ark film where they put the Lost Ark of the Covenant in this giant warehouse full of government stuff and
yes,
in a box.
Along with the Jesus tomb ossuaries.
Brad's point is that might be the equivalent in UFO terms. the Lost Ark of the Covenant, the one case, might be sitting in the Air Force files, publicly available, but nobody's ever looked at it and then taken what's in there and followed up on it in terms of an actual investigation and tracked leads down. And it would be a tremendously daunting effort, and it would require a fair amount of resources to do that.
Yeah.
But instead of doing that, ufology is focused, and I mean, no offense to these folks, but on Roswell, crash flying saucers, government cover-ups, and to a lesser extent, alien abductions over the last 20 or 30 years. Instead of, and this is where I definitely agree with Brad, instead of investigating cases, they've come to conclusions, many of them, and then they've used those three or four things to bolster their conclusions. And that's where I break ranks with them. I don't think you can come to a conclusion yet, and I think you should have still been going through the data that was there, trying to ferret out those really good cases. Like the Kelly Johnson case, which was buried for years until it was discovered in those files. And it's a great case. So how many more Kelly Johnson cases might be sitting in there? Who knows?
What's the future for UFO documentary maker Paul Kimball? Are you looking at the next 10 best cases as a future project?
Well, I have nothing against dirty, filthy lucre, I suppose, even small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
So if I thought that there was a market out there and somebody wanted to buy it, I'd probably do that film. But it's not something that I'm actually actively going to pursue, simply because I think, you know, the top 10 cases says it all for me. And so I would just be repeating myself if I went and did, okay, here's the next 10.
As you said, Bruce McAbee and the New Zealand case and Trinidadi and Socorro, and I mean, there are at least half a dozen other cases that would be worthy, but perhaps would require a slightly larger budget in order to be able to produce.
My answer would be life is short, hopefully not too short. I hope I live another 8,000 years or something in a robot body.
Yes.
Maybe Jessica Alba's robot body, I don't know. But you only have so much time in your career to do so many things. So I've done the top 10 list. Like I said, if somebody told me, hey, we'll give you enough money to do a decent job on another 10, then I'd probably say yes, because sure, I get a car to pay off and stuff. But there are other stories out there I'm more interested in telling, other things that I'm more interested in doing. And frankly, I'm not sure for the moment that I have anything left to say on the UFO phenomenon in film. I did a bio on Stan, one of the legendary figures in ufology. I delved into the MJ-12 hoax, as I think it is, or not hoax if you're on the other side. I looked at a particular case, in the case of Aztec, and then I did the top 10 UFO cases. I'm not sure, in terms of a television sense, there's much left I could say. At the moment, I can still do my blogging and my own research or whatever as a hobby, but as a professional filmmaker, there are a lot of other topics that I'd like to tackle in and out of the paranormal. So I'm kind of hoping to still do paranormal-related films, but one of the things that I pitched is like a top 10, because I do like that format, top 10 cryptozoological creatures. You know, number 8,
yeah,
Yeti.
Yeah,
number
yeah,
7,
yeah, 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 yeah. And Lauren Coleman would be a great help on that, too, along with Nick Redfern and those crazed British cryptozoological researchers.
Yeah, Lauren, Nick, Jonathan Downs. I mean, there's an awful lot of good people out there.
Yeah.
That would be a fun film to do, too. So in my case, if you've just done, and I'm not saying I've just done Hamlet, don't get me wrong, but if you've just done Hamlet, why would you go do Hamlet again? Or even another Shakespeare play. You might actually then want to go do a Eugene O'Neill play, do something more modern.
Got
and then
it.
Maybe you go back to Shakespeare in 3 or 4 years. So in the UFO context, the one film I will tell you I would like to do, and I have sort of bounced this idea around, is a film that I call Saucer Smeared. And it would be a ufological road trip with Redfern, Tonys, Greg Bishop, Tim Binal and I, and maybe Chris McBride, because you should always have one actress on your trip. Just getting in an RV like your pal Cherniak did, and instead of being serious like he was, kind of going through the U.S. and just being sort of Hunter S. Thompson crazy and looking at the UFO phenomenon from a cultural point of view, sort of like Trekkies did for the Star Trek kind of thing, and not making fun of it, but having fun with it, and I think there's a difference.
Yeah.
And the idea is at the end of the film, you know, we'd wind up in Key West, Florida, at the sort of holy grail of ufological curmudgeons, Jim Moseley, and you know, this, our whole trip would be designed to go meet this legendary figure within ufology that you either hate or love one way or another. And that's actually in development here, so I am working on that. But I wouldn't view that so much as a UFO film. It would be a cultural, social film that just happens to touch upon ufology. And it would allow us, guys that like UFOs, to have some fun One of the things we'd really like to do is we'd like to go toilet paper the very large array. That would be on our list. So, you know, and then Seth Shostak's house, we'd find out where he lives, and we'd go do something to his front lawn, like, mm-hmm. you know, take RVs and pull wheelies and burn up his lawn or something.
Well, that would be much easier than toilet papering the Very Large Array telescope down there in New Mexico. Having been there, until you actually get there and you look at the vastness of the technology there, just how much ground it covers, it's breathtaking.
Well, yeah, no, I was there about 3 or 4 years ago. And the other thing, too, is that the area is loaded with fire ants. You can't walk 5 feet without getting fire ants or whatever crawling up your leg and stinging you. So it's not a particularly pleasant area to hang out. Maybe we could figure out some technological way to beam a fake signal to SETI from aliens and then get them to put out a press release saying they'd finally contacted an alien race and then pull the rug out from them or something. Which would be a very Jim Moseley thing to do.
Desperately seeking Moseley, yes.
Yeah, I like that one, too. That's good. There was a filmmaker here in Halifax. He did a film called Adam Lilley, Cheeseburgers, Guns, and the American Dream. It was a good film for CTV, and basically he went on a road trip throughout the United States, and his end goal was to get on The Price is Right, because for some reason he was a huge Bob Barker fan. He visits a brothel outside of Vegas, and he actually is, I think, the last person to ever interview Hunter S. Thompson, because he got him just before Thompson topped himself. And all these sort of crazy things, he goes through America doing this stuff, kind of like Barat, only with the more polite Canadian thing.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's what I'd like to do. I'd like to do a Barat for ufology with Redfern and Bishop and those other guys tagging along.
You mentioned your blog, and not only do you have one, but you have at least three that I know of.
Yes, The Other Side of Truth, which you can find at www.redstarfilms.blogspot.com. which is sort of a general blog. You can find pictures of actresses as well as commentary about the UFO phenomenon. So the one that's particular to Best Evidence, I set one up particularly for the film, you can find at www.bestevidence.blogspot.com. And that one will be solely and is solely devoted to the film. So at some point I'll be putting more video clips up of outtakes, so you don't have to wait for the DVD, and stills from animation and insider stuff. The process of making the film was, for a lot of reasons, both personally and professionally draining. So at the moment, besides being in pre-production for another unrelated film to UFOs, you know, I'm just trying to take a couple weeks off and not really blog much and just get away from it all, because it really, April was not a good month, Errol. You know, it was my annus horribilis, as the Queen would say, or monthus horribilis. So, you know, May is turning out a little bit better, and I'm just taking it easy, but there will be stuff popping up on those blogs. Towards the end of the month, it'll be getting busier again.
You're saying that April was not a particularly good month. Are you suggesting that you had problems delivering the production itself?
I delivered the film, 3 days before it aired? Which, you know, if you're not in the film and television industry, you might go, oh, well, you know, so what? 3 days to spare, right? No, you're supposed to deliver a month before it airs so their techies can go at it, and if there's a problem, they can send it back. And the truth is, the film was originally supposed to be delivered, as I mentioned to you the other day, in December of 2005. It was originally contracted, pre-licensed by Spaceback, I think in March of 2005. And I was working on Fields of Fear, the Fern Belzil doc. I wanted to finish that one, and that took a lot longer than I thought. And so, anyway, Space gave me tons and tons of extra time to do it. Kudos to them. But towards the end, there's no question in April, and I jokingly tell people I came close to a nervous breakdown, and it's not really true, but there's no question that I was frayed because we had a deadline, and you just do not call a network and say, by the way, I know you've put this on your programming schedule, but can you take it off because I can't deliver? So, I mean, not good. So over the years with Space, I built up a lot of credit, I think, as being a good guy. I used a lot of mine, and that's what you build up credit for. You do good work so that in the future, when you might need somebody to cut you some slack, they will. And in this case, Space did, although they were not happy, the late delivery. They were happy with the film, though. And so that eventually goes a long way to sort of saying, well, okay, don't ever do that again. I think they also appreciated the fact that the reason for the late delivery, a lot of it was simply because I was trying to do the best job I could. And my dad afterwards gave me a very sage piece of advice that I always need to remember. He said, you'll never be perfect. Nothing you ever do will be perfect. And he knows me. He said, you will never be satisfied with anything you ever do. But you have to look at it and say, okay, it's not perfect for you, but is it good enough for everybody else? And that was the real problem I ran into with this film, is I was trying to make it perfect. And so, yeah, April, you know, not good. People who know me, like my, you know, I was gone. I was off the grid. If you weren't working with me, I wasn't talking to you. I was sleeping in the office, and not in the way that some people who mock you UFO guys say, oh, you know, they get so wrapped up. It wasn't UFOs. It was, so there was fallout. April, bad month. May, turning out to be somewhat better month. So, but
good.
That's the kind of thing that the next time some of the folks on UFO Updates complain about documentary filmmakers, even if they feel hard done by, I would say to them, maybe you were, but take a step back and realize that these are real people who have real lives, this is their job, and it probably, unless they're complete hacks, and if you're working for Nat Geo or the History Channel or something, you're probably not a complete hack. These are people who probably did the best job they thought they could do. And the fact that they might not have done the job you wanted them to do, don't hold that against them personally. Because sometimes I hear people say, these are horrible people who are out to destroy ufology or whatever. No, they're just people who have a difference of opinion, maybe, did a different film than you thought they were going to do. But it's a business, and it can be a grinding, crushing business at times, like any other. You know, boo-hoo, poor me. But in my case, as Stuart Miller would tell you, because I am invested in the UFO phenomenon, maybe it had a different angle to it. I'm happy to tell people, because, you know, I am proud of the film at the end of the day, and I'm proud of the work that everybody put into it. And if people like the film, most of the credit goes to a whole bunch of other people, and I'm just first among equals, maybe. So if people want to say, Paul Kimball made a great film, I would hope that they would always remember to say, Paul Kimball, Chris McBride, Thor Henriksen, John Rosbrough, and whoever else's name is in the end credits, Jim Kimball. Those are the people who made a good film.
Of course. Paul Kimball, I want to thank you for joining us, and I want to thank you for a damn good documentary. I trust that eventually it will be seen everywhere so that all the people who are listening to us going, damn, I want to see that, can do so.
I hope so, too. Every filmmaker wants their films to be seen, but I'm not going to say this film will change the world, but within the context of the UFO phenomenon, maybe it can do some good. So, yeah, I hope people see it.
Thank you, Paul Kimball.
No problem, Errol. Happy to be on Strange Days Indeed once again.
And look forward to doing it again, too. Take care of yourself.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Things that make you go
And as he does every 2 weeks on Strange Days Indeed, Alfred Lemberg joins us from his home in Enterprise, Alabama. Hi, Alfred.
Hey, how you doing, Errol?
I'm doing.
It's great to hear from you again, and I must say right off the bat, I'm going to very quickly run out of superlatives that I can use every week when I'm trying to describe the show, because they just apparently seem to be getting better and better and better.
Really? And you like this one, too?
Yes, I like this one. Even when, it was earlier in the week and you told me that that Paul Kimball was going to be the guest, and I thought, oh, Gene, I can begin to look forward for another opportunity to be righteously contrary or constructively impertinent or maybe even a little deliberately nasty. But no. Lord knows that over the years that I've known Paul and been associated with Paul, he's been on opposite sides of the fence. And in many situations, I've written thousands of words on the subject, and there have been dozens of unflattering illustrations that I've composed. Lately, what's happening? Do I detect an even-handedness that I didn't see before, that there's more balance and less cant? It's like I've come awake in some kind of new dimensional reality, or Mars must be in some strange retrograde, or maybe I've had another stroke, you know? It is. But Paul Kimball just seems different somehow to me, and I'm wondering, you know, has Paul himself changed, or perhaps maybe me a little bit? I don't know.
Maybe you're both mellowing with age.
Well, maybe that's it. I'm detecting a seriousness and longevity in legs that I didn't really see before, I guess, and I'm coming to appreciate a little more in Mr. Kimball what many others seem to find appreciable. And maybe it's this. Maybe I'm keeping my friends close, but my enemies closer. You know?
You really want that in there, huh?
I thought it was a nice little joke. At any rate, he was talking about some things that I think are key, and I really appreciate the fact that he brought them out. One of the things that he started talking about, which I thought was kind of interesting, was his reason for doing a top 10 UFO kind of thing, you know, and it, for my money, it could be argued that, oh, come on, we kind of cheapen it and turn it into something sillier than it needs to be. But when you look at it the way he was looking at it, that top 10 lists are popular, that people like a little sugar with their medicine, that they like to be entertained while they're informed, and again, that he's trying to make a film for the largest possible audience. I can't argue with any of that. And what I really can't argue about is where he got his top 10 list at all, that it was polled from genuine, uncompromised, it was polled from real expertise. And you've got to respect that.
Especially when you consider the number of people in the field that he used.
Really. And it was good people and people that we haven't heard very much from, and I've got a suspicion are going to be heard more from in the future. Something that Mr. Kimball kind of reminded me of in his explication about his own documentary effort and the films that he's made, he mentioned that he was trying to make the film for the biggest possible audience. And I think that the way he's approaching that is he's doing in a positive way what government and religion do in such a negative way, and that is appeal to the left half of the bell curve, the very much maligned and disrespected left half of the bell curve. And I'm talking about the alleged so-called bell curve regarding intelligence. With regard to that left half, those are the people that kind of build our whole world for us, and after the scientists figure it out, the engineers, the left half that I'm talking about, really put our world together for us and deserve a little more respect, and they should be included in these efforts to include the biggest possible audience, and UFOs is just one of those kinds of things, I think. One of the points that he brought up is that whereas some of the cases that he was talking about in his top 10 list were moved around to satisfy content and production and movement and what have you, he'd mentioned that the top five were pretty good in their own right for being like a spear point for real penetration into a scientific mainstream or a cultural mainstream that is very dismissive of UFOs. And I have to agree with that. I think his top five there could be a good spear point to carry us forward into something like that. But there remains a presumption that he's making that I'm kind of uncomfortable with and really should be addressed. And that presumption is that mainstream science is only looking for an excuse to do a serious investigation on UFOs. And really, I don't think anything could be further from the truth. Point is, I think they know about UFOs, and I think that they know that there is something out there that they really don't want to have a look at, and that there is an abundant excuse to perform that investigation, given the anecdotal evidence, the photographic evidence, the historical evidence, the artistic and physical and personal, and all of those things that Mr. Kimball reflected, apparently, in his documentary, that Fermi was right. Fermi saying, essentially, that if there were aliens in UFOs, if there was an other, that the universe would essentially be crawling with them, and we would know it. And the fact is we do know it. So he has a presumption there that I think mainstream science is really just looking for every excuse to come on board and have a good hard look at this thing, when I really don't think anything could be further from the truth.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that one.
I have to make mention here that I may be sounding like I've seen this documentary, and I have not. I'm only going on what's been said about it, and I understand that Stuart Miller, will be doing a review about this, and Greg Bishop will be doing the honors with regard to a review, along with Mr. Redfern, too.
At UFOmystic.com.
And I wondered who else was going to be reviewing, and then it occurred to me that inasmuch as I got mail from Mr. Kimball himself saying he was going to send me a copy, that I am also going to be reviewing this. And I'm going to be having a good hard look at it. I'm going to look for that opportunity to be righteously contrary and constructively impertinent and deliberately nasty. But I don't think I'm going to have an opportunity to do so this time. What did Dave Frelat say last week? Is that it was a wonderful documentary and just perfect twice?
Yes.
Mr. Frelat has some idiosyncratic credit with me, so I'm impressed. And if Mr. Frelat's impressed, I'm kind of thinking, hey, dude, you might be impressed yourself, you know, so we'll have to see.
Talking of Dave Frelat, what did you think of his take this week?
Just very incisive and just going right to the bone, you know, diving the deepest on the most critical points of the day. And again, it's another concern provoked by something that's going on in UFO updates. And with regard to that, a few Roswell questions for the last 30 days. I'm getting ready to shove coat hangers into my eyes.
Oh, dear.
I can appreciate really trying to get this sorted out and down and looking for all the facts and where everything hooks up. And I have all the respect for that in the world. But when was sunrise and sunset, daylight savings time, angle of the sun, the same questions asked over and over and over again, the way Frelat was talking about. You get the impression that folks are just kind of trying to parse this thing into abject lifelessness, and you kind of wonder why. I think it's no secret and no argument that Roswell is a peculiar case, but certainly not one of the more important cases that could be going on. Oh, man, when you put it all together and you think about the people involved and you think about the officialdom, the media that was involved, and all of this happening right on all the time, the question just gets begged. Where is all this message traffic? Why do these disparate witnesses provide similar testimonies? There's just something really crazy going on there. And now I've reminded myself of what I really wanted to talk about with regard to Mr. Frelat, was his concern with questions. And I think a quote from him would be, we have plenty of questions, and that's not the problem. We need more answers. And I can appreciate the spirit of what Dave's talking about, because on the face of it, we do want closure. We do want some kind of conclusiveness. We're not likely to get it, especially with regard to UFOs. So here's my contention. I contend that answers are only as good as the questions that provoke them. And what I mean by that is I think that that makes the question that is being asked a lot more important than the answers could ever be by an order of magnitude. We need better questions.
I would give equal weight to the answers were they to be forthcoming.
That's the contention right there. I have some example questions that could be asked just right along the line of what we're talking about here. How about an answer to this question and expecting a forthcoming answer? And okay, the question is, how can mainstream science continue to dismiss UFOs given six categories of evidence that we just finished talking about, the anecdotal, photographic, historical, artistic, physical, and personal? How can they continue to dismiss UFOs given those six categories and the fullness of each? Question number two. How does science get by being decidedly unscientific about UFOs and the ancillaries of UFOs? Question number three. How does Dr. Shostak, Dr. Nichols, Dr. Magaha, Dr. Shermer, and I believe it's only Mr. Oberg, et al., among all of these individuals, how do they continue to be the front opposition for UFOs when they are so decidedly uninformed about same? I don't know how these guys can front the opposition when they are so patently clueless about what they're talking about, which has been demonstrated over and over and over again. If we're just talking about Mr. Friedman and his debate with Mr. Magaha or his debate with Dr. Krauss, that, oh man, last century it inspired me to write epic poetry, comparing Krauss and Friedman to Goliath and David.
The difficulty with all of those names that you've named is, A, the media runs to them when they want a counterpoint because they haven't done their homework either. And they're hoping that the counterpoint provided by those people that you mentioned will save them from having to do the research.
But, you know, it never does, and it never has for, you know, year after year after year.
Well, you and I both know that, as does the listener. But the media in general does not know that. They make an assumption that because these people are so prominent in their opposition to the existence of UFOs, that they must have done their homework.
And that they're very public and very well known because they get a frontage and a moneyed support that their opposition does not get.
Exactly. Look at all the money that's poured into what was formerly known as PSYCOP and is now known as CSI. Crime scene investigation, and there is no crime scene, and there is no investigation.
Back to Mr. Kimball for a second, with regard to his DVD that's going to be released here in a couple of weeks, and he was talking about DVD extras.
Well, that's going to be several months, I think, rather than a couple of weeks. But the extras will be interesting.
Well, yeah. It occurs to me that he is in a position to really pack that DVD full of some very key stuff. Some killer stuff all in one place, and I hope he does.
And especially with the people that he spent time with, Richard Hall and Brad Sparks, and of course Stan Friedman and Stuart Miller needs be included on the extras on his DVD.
Oh, for sure. If for no other reason to get that Rendlesham description that really wasn't said anywhere else, but Kimball couldn't get a good segue to it, so didn't use it. When Kimball was in Rendlesham Forest and they were out there kind of doing the trek and walking around and, mm-hmm. and looking at this stuff, very interesting about Rendlesham Forest having all the activity that it's historically had, that strange things are always seem to be happening out at Rendlesham,
mm-hmm.
not just since the United States started storing its nuclear weapons there, you know?
Ooh, could there be an underground base in Rendlesham Forest with a section of the forest that slides back to allow intro and extra?
Sure, why not?
Why not?
Let's go for it. I'm going to start reporting it as fact anyway. The one thing that I do have to allow is that he'd mentioned that while he was out there, he was being, I don't think it's a stretch to say that he was buzzed by black helicopters with no markings.
Yeah, the black helicopters were interesting. I thought there was a certain irony, given the history of Rendlesham, that it would be Paul Kimball who would lose the videotape of that whole day. And there is a weird one, too, huh?
Take that weirdness and put it together with the fact that especially training helicopters, which is what he wrote them off as doing touch-and-goes over there at the neighboring active runway, black helicopters with no markings is just weird by virtue of the fact that especially training helicopters need to be seen by other helicopters above any other consideration, all right? So if those helicopters were training, I don't think that they were probably in accordance with standard safety procedures in operation around all aviation bases that indicate how helicopters are moved and how they're to be lit and marked to preclude mid-air collisions. And black helicopters with no markings is just unbelievably weird. All by themselves.
Good catch, Alfred Lemberg, former military helicopter pilot.
Yes, I did fly. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Another couple of things that Paul Kimball was talking about that was very impressive, I thought, is that he made every indication that after all of the misdirections, after all of the factual inflations, after all of the tedious repetitions and demolished men of straw, all it takes is one UFO. One true UFO, one real case, and it's a whole new ball game. And after all the many thousands of reports that have been vetted, and again, hearkening back to what we were talking about with regard to anecdotal, photographic, historical, artistic, physical, personal, after all of those things, there's not one true case? I think not, Mr. Bruce Knapp.
Well, Mr. Lemberg, I, again, agree with you.
How could you not?
Well, exactly. How could I be doing what I'm doing and not agree with you?
Another point, another item from Mr. Kimball. I was gratified how clear he was that skeptobunkies Everybody knows who they are, the class Kurtzians, the Pelicanists, the persons that stand on the other side to one who is willing to consider them as a real thing in a real world. I was very gratified to hear Mr. Kimball indicate that skeptobunkies are ufologically illiterate. They are uninformed. They are biased. They are unscientific. They are not up to informational speed. They are unqualified. I was very gratified to hear him make those indications.
I actually had a really good time with Paul Kimball.
He's got a lot to say, and he says it quick. You can't hardly shake a stick at that, although, you know, like, I will take every opportunity to try.
As I've done in the past.
You can't expect me to go belly up in one go. I've got to take a few tries at the hurdle.
I think what we need to do is when you get a copy of the DVD or of the program and you've done the review, we need to have you both on this program together.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be up for that.
It would make for an interesting discussion, I think.
Yeah, I think it would. If not an outright Donnybrook.
I have the feeling that it would turn into a mutual admiration society.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you're right. A love fest. That's what it would be.
One that would come as a relief, I think, to many people.
You think our consternation is bugging that many folks, huh?
Well, I don't know for sure. I'm only making assumptions here, and then I'm just some guy stuck up there in Canada who doesn't comment and observe too much on a regular basis.
Yeah, but stuck up in Canada, that makes you morally superior.
Well, I didn't want to say that. But
Yes, leave it to the morally inferior to point that out.
No. Self-deprecation.
Yes, I'm a grand self-deprecator.
Yes.
One thing that Paul mentioned is that he was willing to admit that it may not be all of that necessary or even desirable to continue to be upset that science is not more involved with UFOs.
Mm.
Why get science interested? And Kimball indicated that maybe people want to get science interested to get respect or to get some kind of idiosyncratic credit or maybe even for personal aggrandizement. I was talking earlier that I don't think science is really interested. I think if EBE landed on the front lawn of the individual concerned and walked in and gave him a hyperdrive and a ray pistol, I think that they'd think that it was still our technology. I really do. I don't have a lot of faith in them doing the right thing in this milieu, given how much corporate interest there is and how much concern for money and position well drives the program in Western civilization anyway.
Well, I'm not holding my breath on that one either.
I want to discourage Mr. Kimball from making a Borat UFO film. Okay, I don't want him to do that. If for no other reason, I just don't want to see him in that lime green jock over-the-shoulder swimming suit that Borat was wearing.
Ooh, that's another ugly picture, isn't it? At the same time, you have to acknowledge the fact that Paul Kimball, being a filmmaker, needs to make film. And as he said, there's not a lot of money to be made in straight UFO documentaries anymore. And hence the best evidence, the top 10 UFO cases that he made.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I can certainly see MTV going for that one, given their audience and the audience that it sounds as if Paul Kimball's future documentary would be aimed at.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I have to allow and point out to Mr. Kimball is that William Jefferson Clinton didn't squander anywhere near the idiosyncratic credit that Mr. Kimball might think he did. As the last elected president, you think, here's this guy, he can still stride the world like a movie star, and boy, I can't think of a Republican president since Eisenhower who would be able to enjoy the same kind of world adoration, I think, as William Jefferson Clinton. So that's all I had, partner. Hope it was enough.
Oh, it's always enough, Albert.
Oh, good.
It's always meaty and to the point and very astute.
meaty, to the point, and astute. I'm putting that on my webpage as an endorsement.
And you may quote me on that.
All right, a quote. Yowl.
I need all the plugs I can get.
Me too. That's probably why we have this very, very wonderful association that we have. Together, we are greater than the sum of our parts. And I meant that in the best possible way.
Oh, I'm sure you did. And that's, I'm not even going to touch that. Thank you, Alfred Lindberg.
Enjoyed it, Errol.
Look forward to the next time.
Auf Wiedersehen, mein Herr. We'll see you next time, buddy.
Yes, we will. Bye, Alfred.
Bye-bye.
Well, that felt like a good one. At least from where I'm sitting, trust you enjoyed it too. And I trust that your interest in the things that you hear about are greatly expanded, and you can add even more information on a daily basis by going to the UFO Updates Archive at virtuallystrange.net. All kinds of news, all kinds of discussion there if you're not aware of it already. Go graze. Over 70,000 messages, as we said a couple of weeks ago. My thanks to Dave Furlott, Paul Kimball, Alfred Lemberg, and you for being out there and having us in your ears. Until next week, bye.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again next Saturday for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.